ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Vivian Kelly.
And I'm Dani Saeed, filling in for Tim Burrows.
This week, is AI writing our headlines? And is it such a problem if it is?
And in a world of massive media corporations, is there still room for the little guy?
Last night, Seven's free-to-air programming came back to linear TV broadcast in parts of South Australia and New South Wales after the Seven Network and Wind Network finally struck a deal.
Yeah, the blackout started on Tuesday and it didn't really last long. It was a really big deal around not just the industry, but a lot of politicians who wanted to jump on it and make a big deal about how free footy wasn't going to be on air in regional South Australia. But that's come back now and we've seen, I understand it's a multi-year deal and we'll sort of start to see some of those sort of free news sport weather staples come back to those regional areas.
Yeah, it wasn't just a big deal for the politicians who wanted to capitalise on the regional narrative and, you know, the sort of media industry. It's a big deal for people who live in areas such as Griffith, Riverland and Mount Gambier because they aren't necessarily across the politics and negotiating that goes into getting the programs they watch onto their screens. So they turn on their television and suddenly there's nothing on that channel because these two corporations, the Seven Network and the Wind Corporation, couldn't agree on the commercial terms of their deal. So Seven provides the content. Wind is the one who actually has access to the broadcast waves, if you will, to get that content into people's homes. People in those areas don't necessarily care that these people in a big boardroom can't agree on what to do about it. They just want to see, as you say, their local news, their live sport, the programs that they like. And they were being directed to, oh, we'll just go to Seven Plus, which is Seven's streaming service. But even though here in the cities, we're very familiar with streaming and a lot of us use it as our primary media consumption habit, in the regions, the evidence is a lot of them still rely on television.
Exactly right. And inevitably, those boardrooms are in big cities. They're not in regional areas. And as a regional boy myself, I can empathise with that. And speaking of TV negotiations,
sports rights are up for grabs again, and it's a real tussle. Are you a keen English Premier League watcher, Dani?
I am, less so these days because for my many sins, I follow Manchester United and they're not as good as they were when I was a child. But we've seen now Nine have got the rights to the English Premier League and they've picked them up from Optus Sport, who've had them for the last decade or so. And what we're going to see now is there's going to be an increase in price, which was announced recently as well. But it's going to be a consolidation of where you can and can't get football rights.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about viewing habits in parts of regional Australia. And those people would love, not everybody, obviously, but would love watching these sports. And increasingly, they're not necessarily available on linear television, which is largely free. Now they have to sign up for Stan Sport or KO or Optus Sport. It's hard to keep track of where these sports end up and how much they cost. If I am a keen watcher of these things, how much am I going to have to pay now?
It was designed to make our lives easier, and instead it seems that we're paying more and more and more. So Stan Sports has gone up in price as of July 1st. So you now pay a minimum of $32 a month. So Stan has a basic plan that costs $12 a month. Stan Sport as an add-on is $20 a month. It's gone up from $15 a month. So it's going to cost you at least $32 a month if you want the sports side of Stan. So that will now include the Premier League, the FA Cup, the Champions League, which they already had in Europe. They're going to have Grand Slam tennis all the four majors. It'll also have rugby, which they've already had for a little period of time.
One thing when KO launched, which was Foxtel's sports streaming offering associated with Binge was it was kind of praised here in Australia because its technology was seen as better than some of the other streamers. Its user experience was really easy compared to some others. It was seen as less glitchy. And I guess in live sport broadcast, those glitches where your streamer freezes probably matters a little bit more. You know, if your rerun of Friends on Netflix freezes, you're going to be annoyed, but you're not going to have a breakdown because you've missed a key moment. So the investment these companies are having to put into these sports technologies is quite large. So is it good business then, given the investment and the potential PR disasters when things go wrong?
Yeah, it was a massive controversy in 2018. Optusport had the rights to the FIFA World Cup, which was being held in Russia at the time. And it was simply a really glitchy app that didn't work for a lot of people. And what ended up happening is that SBS, who will have the rights to the upcoming World Cup in the United States and have historically had the FIFA World Cup in Australia, picked up those rights and bought them out and basically offered to host for people so that people could watch the FIFA World Cup. It's a really big deal for Nine, who I've written about this in Crikey, are trying to become a bit of a sports overlord. They have made a significant amount of money by selling off Domain, its real estate business. And so a lot of that will go back into dividends for shareholders. But a lot of that has freed up cash to possibly chase the rights to things like the AFL, which they haven't had for 20 years. There's been reports in the News Corp papers that Nine are looking to pick up the entirety of the NRL deal. So currently they split the rights to the NRL with Foxtel. There's been reports that they're trying to cover all of that together with Stan and their free-to-air product. I've also reported that was part of their pitch for the AFL rights when they were last up for grabs.
And speaking of sources of revenue for media companies, up next we'll be talking about Sydney community radio station, FBI.
It's been a tough year for Sydney community radio station FBI. In February, they announced a raft of redundancies and then in June had to go back to the community asking for donations to keep them running.
They're adamant they're keeping the lights on, but it's a battle for the broadcaster that has been the start for so many Aussie media and music careers.
Tyson Coe is the managing director of FBI and joins us here.
Hello.
So, Tyson, talk to me about the importance of FBI and what it means to the Sydney community for people who might be perhaps tuning in from elsewhere in the country and don't appreciate its legacy and its future potential.
Well, I think a lot of people around the country would appreciate community radio and have the equivalents in their area. But what makes FBI really special is that we have a policy of playing 50% Australian music without fail, and half of that is from Sydney-based artists. So because of that, we've been able to champion and push a lot of local music and propel them onto incredible careers, but also more in a media sense. There's a lot of people that have come through the station over the last 22 years that have gone on to work at other media organisations, both in front and behind the camera, but also in the arts and cultural sector more broadly. So it's always been a breeding ground for talent across the country. And so that's why we're really proud of what we do at FBI.
The financial challenges that have come for FBI lately, is that, what do you attribute that to?
You know, I think it's a funny thing. I mean, you know, we are a cultural organisation, but we've been quite bad at asking for things, both from our listeners, from the government in terms of grants, in terms of philanthropy. And really, it's how a lot of cultural organisations are able to exist, working on philanthropy and development and leaning on their supporters. So a lot of our listeners, unfortunately, kind of take what we do for granted. We give our product away for free, and we know that less than 1% of people that tune into the station convert into being a giver to the station. So I think for us, really just gone about our business without actually impressing upon our audience their responsibility in keeping us afloat.
Now, I know you're staying optimistic about the future of FBI, but just so people understand the importance of this moment, should it disappear, what do you think would be the impact of that? What would we lose?
Well, I think community radio, it's not just media. It's not just being entertained every single time you switch on to us on the dial or stream any of our programs. It really is about community. I mean, it's a physical space that so many young people volunteer at, that come through our doors. We're able to facilitate various workshops and events. And obviously, the music that we play and the artists that we support, I mean, we make sure that we include First Nations artists onto every single weekly playlist of new music that we bring onto the station. So, you know, there's just so many ways in which supporting us goes towards supporting the community as a whole in general. And I think if we were to disappear, a lot of that support would also disappear as well, which would be a real shame.
Tyson Coe, the Managing Director of FBI, thank you for joining us on Medialand.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Vivian Kelly.
And I'm Dani Syed.
It feels like every week, Dani, we're fed more information or propaganda about how artificial intelligence is either our saviour or our destroyer.
There's a lot of hyperbole out there, Viv, and the technology isn't going anywhere. And audiences and journalists are thinking more and more about the impact of AI on the news.
Lots of news organisations are trying to figure out their position and even building their own tools. Earlier this year, we found out that News Corp is building its own generative AI, NewsGPT.
And putting its journalists into boot camps to learn how to use it. One of the people trying to figure out what the possible future might look like is Dr. Phoebe Matich. She's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Queensland University of Technology, and she joins us on Medialand today. Hello, Phoebe.
Hi, guys.
Phoebe, one of the things I've seen online recently is people saying, I don't hate AI. I hate generative AI. Can you maybe break down the difference between those two things? Because I think often people just think there's AI and that's it, and it's either good or it's bad. But this use of generative, what's the difference there?
So AI is essentially a branch of computer science focused on simulating human intelligence. So the way they do this is by making really complicated computer networks and algorithms, or like processes that are called like neural networks. So they're supposed to simulate how the human brain works. But they are generally predictive systems that use statistical rules to understand patterns. And like, they're also informed here by machine learning, which is training. And they can understand language. So that's called natural language processing. And that's where we get large language models. They can also understand visual information. So they, for example, they can be used to diagnose tumors, or they can make recommendations based on past behavior or rules and goals. So then generative AI really refers to systems where these sorts of predictive patterns are used to make new content. So if you asked DALL-E to create an image of a cat eating an apple, the system would go and look up images of cats and images of apples, and then also how people eat apples. And then it'll try and create something that looks stylistically appropriate that follows what you've asked it to show.
And in newsrooms, it's increasingly being adopted, particularly these language models and generative AI. And I know that some journalists feel like they're kind of signing their own death warrant each time they use it. You know, they might be asked by their newsroom superiors to run their news story through ChatGPT or a custom-built equivalent as a sub-editing tool. But obviously every time they put information into that tool, the tool learns more and they feel like, I actually don't want to participate in putting myself out of a job, even though I would love to quickly find all the typos in my copy. How do you think people can balance that when they are being forced to use this tool, but they're not necessarily ethically on board?
That's a very big question. So in February this year, me and some of my colleagues from RMIT, from Washington State University, and also from QUT, we released a report that was looking, it was the product of several studies about the use of Gen AI in newsrooms. And there are a bunch of different really broad ways that AI tech is being used, and some of them are really behind the scenes. There are many different news organizations, as we know, and there's many different AI tools, and there's also many different functions that they can serve in a news context. So they might be used for brainstorming and enriching. That might look like creating a storyboard for a TV news story, or it might be used for like transcription, et cetera, for an interview. And then we can also see AI start to being used in editing. So that might look like removing watermarks from an image or adding something as simple as a background blur to a like news cross to a source. Or it might look like visualizing public data or creating an illustration that is either photorealistic or not photorealistic. And that might all come under editing sort of practices. And then there is creating new content, whether that's a news story or an image of the distant past or the distant future, or using generative expand to expand the like frame of an image. So there are numerous different ways that this tech can be used, and it really depends on the organization's priorities and then also the kind of freedoms that they give individual journalists. So I understand that News Corp seems to be pivoting to a very integrated use of Gen AI in a lot of their production, but that's definitely not the case in every newsroom, and a lot of newsrooms are kind of wanting humans to stay involved in the production of news.
Do you think that newsrooms and reporters and editors have a solid grasp of how AI works and subsequently perhaps some of the dangers involved in over-leveraging it?
Again, that's a really good question. I think there's a lot of anxiety out there. I think also there's a lot of different levels of kind of computer literacy, not just in newsrooms, but across the population in general. So some might be more aware of how these tools work, and some people certainly love learning about them. And then others might be kind of a bit more traditional or focused on like handwriting things, for example, and maybe they find it more intimidating. And definitely one of the concerns that we identified among news journalists is that they're not sure that their colleagues might all feel comfortable or be able to learn the tools that well, especially when they're evolving so quickly.
I know a lot of newsrooms are told about the benefits of AI from the perspective of productivity or the benefits to the business. You know, we can very quickly check our copy for typos and make sure it's in house style. As you mentioned, you can quickly alter an image, which would save time and resources and perhaps be redirected to other tasks within the business. What's in it for the consumer, though? What's the benefit to the person at home of journos and newsrooms using these tools?
I think the jury is probably still out as to whether there's a benefit. So our studies also included speaking to news audiences and trying to figure out how they felt about things. Generally, they felt more comfortable about journalists using AI that they had kind of experience with themselves. So, for example, background blur or removing red eye from a photo of some people. In terms of news production, I think news audiences are actually really concerned about the prospect for news to be produced without humans at all. I think there's a pretty strong awareness that Gen AI tools aren't always reliable or aren't necessarily going to quote the right sources or provide accurate and updated facts. So when these sorts of things are being really like pushed for cost cutting, news audiences are definitely worried about the kind of degradation of the service that the news is supposed to provide to the public.
Personally, Phoebe, I think every teenager and young person should have to go through the perils that I did of removing red eyes from photos. It should not be that easy. But there is a real fear in some news consumers. So you mentioned that some of them are fine if it is doing something simple like removing a red eye, but if it's something they don't understand, they might be more fearful of it. Do you think newsrooms and, you know, leaders in the media community have a role to play in explaining it better to audiences so that they understand what's happening with the product they're consuming?
Absolutely. I think that's really important. So one of the concerns that we also identified in news audiences is that they, about 40% of our sample were suspicious that they had already encountered Gen AI content in the news, but that news organizations were not disclosing that. So there's a real issue there in terms of transparency, but it's not necessarily as simple as news organizations providing AI policies saying that we will keep a human involved in the process. As I said, there are so many different ways that Gen AI can be used in a news production context, and there's really little clarity on what kind of level of use would need to be disclosed. So if you're using the removal of red eye, do you really need to like disclose that? But then if you're using a visual news presenter, that is absolutely something that audiences would want to be disclosed. And there have been cases where that has been used without disclosure. So I think part of the concern is that audiences may actually be learning quite a lot about how Gen AI might work and might pop up in things, and they might be suspicious of that happening in news, but then there's no kind of information about how it is actually being used.
Phoebe, do media companies have bigger problems than AI when it comes to audience trust, or is this one of the big picture items that audiences tell you they're worried about when it comes to trusting the media?
The reality is that news organizations have been losing public trust for a really long time. So in this context, Gen AI isn't necessarily like a new issue so much as a kind of intensification of some of these existing problems. So one of the things that we might find is that news audiences want to feel seen in a news kind of story, or want their stories to be told and recognized by journalists. And we already know that before Gen AI was a thing, that may not always happen in certain contexts. And it's definitely true that some poor practices or bad behaviors on the part of one journalist or a couple at a certain organization can poison the well for the entire community when it comes to what news can do. Like, for example, when a bunch of news outlets around the world jumped on the rumors of weapons of mass destruction that kind of led to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, I think it was. That is definitely something that well precedes Gen AI, but it's still kind of evidence of perhaps relying a bit too closely on what politicians say. There's a bunch of different issues there that have caused trust to kind of decline in the community in relation to journalism.
You're listening to Media Land, and we're speaking to Phoebe Matic, a postdoctoral researcher at the Queensland University of Technology.
Phoebe, we saw a big change in the market this week from US tech company Cloudflare, where they have introduced a model of blocking AI scrapers from websites that are hosted by the company. And the company spruiks it as a benefit for publishers who won't have AI scrapers and AI models constantly trawling through their content. Is that, what do you make of that shift in IP protection, and why does that frustrate big AI tech companies?
That's a really good question. It's honestly a really interesting development that has happened in the past week. And in many ways, it's a good thing. So the way that AI companies have kind of developed these tools is by using what are called scrapers to pull as much information as they can off the public internet. And obviously that includes things like Shakespeare. Like, we can ask a Gen AI model to speak as though it's writing a Shakespeare play, and we can tell that models have been trained on that content that has been freely available on the internet. So it is a really good thing, in my opinion, that it will be more difficult for scrapers to work like that. But essentially, it's also set up to mean that content might be legally licensed, and that is something that some organizations have more capacity to do than others. So there's a big disjunct here between a major news organization like News Corp and a freelance photojournalist or an independent musician or other types of like visual and audio artists. So yeah, there's definitely a step in the right direction, but there's still going to be IP concerns in terms of what's available on the public internet, depending on who's running that website.
Phoebe Matic is a postdoctoral researcher at the Queensland University of Technology. Phoebe, thank you so much for joining us on Medialand.
Thank you so much for having me.
Seen anything halfway decent this week, Dani?
Viv, I on the weekend went to see the new F1 movie with Brad Pitt, and it was bad. It was really bad.
Loving the honesty of the review here. I say, seen anything halfway decent, and you say, I saw a movie, it was bad.
Viv, I was really excited for it for a really long period of time. I'm a big Formula One fan. But I don't think a movie has so spectacularly failed, and not to misuse, as I inevitably will, Alison Bechdel's joke, but nothing has so spectacularly failed the Bechdel test as F1 did. It's amazing how the only significant women's plotline was the subordinate love interest.
Right, so it's not a very female-centric film, I'm guessing.
No. The racing scenes are incredible. It's really well shot, but not somewhere you want to go for a plot line that's anything more than paper thin.
Right, well, if you want something a bit more female-focused, I can recommend The Shark Whisperer, which is a documentary currently on Netflix. It's about a scuba diver, free diver, and shark observer called Ocean Ramsey. Yes, her name is Ocean. And she is sort of in the business of trying to reframe how people perceive and fear sharks. She does so by free diving with them and quite controversially interacting with them, including touching them and holding on to their fins and riding along with them. It's got quite a nuanced discussion about social media, women's bodies, how we get attention for the causes that we care about. There's really interesting nuances and dynamics around what makes a researcher, what makes a scientist, what makes something reliable information when we're talking about something as vast and misunderstood as the ocean. And the footage they have of the sharks is just simply incredible. And it definitely does tackle, probably better than the F1 film, the dynamics of, you know, being female and working in a male-dominated space.
Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And how do you feel about headlines and copy made by AI? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thanks to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
And Dani, thanks so much for stepping in for the fortnight. Tim will be back next week.
It's always such a pleasure, Viv. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.